Hi, welcome. My name is Christine Mastrangelo, and I welcome you all to the Boston Book Festival. We're celebrating our 11th year and are so happy to be able to expand our programming out to Roxbury, so it is truly a citywide celebration of how words ignite our imaginations and how we can all be brung together to celebrate books and the written word. I'd like to just throw it out there just for 10 seconds for each and every one of you to maybe just take a second to turn to your neighbor and just share why you either love books or why you love the Boston Book Festival. And I can start. I love books because I feel, I love reading because I feel that it connects me more to a very complicated but beautiful world. And I love the festival and have been coming every single year since our since 11 years ago, because I learned something new that's completely out of the realm of my thinking every single session that I attend. So take 10 seconds and just share why you love books or the festival.
I love books because I grew up with them.
All right, awesome. Beautiful. All right, that was great, thank you so much. So Boston Book Festival is a nonprofit. 10 seconds is over. Hello, all right, we're gonna continue. Thank you so much for your enthusiasm. We are a nonprofit. Thank you. I appreciate that. We are a nonprofit, and we do, for the next 11 years, we do really rely on any donation that you can give, whether it's $5, $50, and maybe the value of your favorite book. So thank you so much. Hopefully you can donate. And please welcome our moderator, Professor Kenneth Mack, whose work, writing, and teachings help us understand and navigate constitutional law, discrimination, and our civil rights. Thanks so much.
Well, we're here today to talk with attorney Benjamin Crump about his new book, just off the presses, entitled Open Season, The Legalized Genocide of Colored People. Ben Crump is somebody who needs very little introduction to this audience, so I'm going to keep my introduction brief. He's a civil rights attorney, author, and speaker who is known for representing the families of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown in their respective cases. He's a frequent contributor to Time magazine. He served as the first African-American president of the Federal Bar Association of the Northern District of Florida, and the first African-American chair of the Florida State University College of Law Board of Directors. He's been featured in documentaries such as NPR's How a Lawyer Got a Nation talking about Trayvon Martin, and BET's I Am Trayvon Martin, A Family's Fight for Justice. His work often concerns civil rights and justice for minority communities. And for that, he has received the AKA Eleanor Roosevelt Award, the NAACP's Thurgood Marshall Award, and the SCLC's Martin Luther King Servant Award. I'm Kenneth Mack. I'm the Lawrence Beall Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. I'm the author of Representing the Race, The Creation of the Civil Rights Lawyer, among other works, and we're here to talk. Our format today is, I think we're going to allow Mr. Crump about 15 minutes to introduce us to his book and the really difficult stories that inspired it. I'm going to ask him questions for maybe another 25 minutes, and after that, you all are going to have the opportunity to ask questions of Mr. Crump, and that will be the remainder of our time. So without further ado, we're gonna start with Mr. Crump and just give him 15 minutes or so to introduce us to this provocative and important book.
Thank you so much, Ken, and thank you all for having me at the Boston Book Festival. And as a trial lawyer, I may stand because and I will tell you, this is my admission, Ken, I told you. This morning I was in Atlanta, Georgia, with Colin Kaepernick, the NFL quarterback and activist, and we were talking to a high school gymnasium of thousands of young people. And so I spoke to Jenna for about 15 minutes and kept them engaged. So if I can do that to these high school students, I feel okay with you all. But in all seriousness, I would just tell you the three reasons that mostly inspired me why to write this book. It was Ben Franklin who said, "Democracy is like two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch." You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know how that vote is going to go. But he said, liberty is making sure that that lamb is well armed to protest that vote. And so with Open Season, I endeavored to help the young lambs in communities of color be able to protest the vote, to give them the information and arm them with intellect and diplomacy to be able to protest the school to prison pipeline, be able to protest the racist Jim Crow laws like Stand Your Ground, to be able to protest voter suppression, be well armed to protest environmental racism that would find the children in South Central Los Angeles has a third of the lung capacity of children growing up in Santa Monica, California. Make sure these young people are well armed to protest the prison industrial complex where minorities who go to prison, oftentimes people go to prison and they are concerned about losing their constitutional rights, where when you're a minority, especially women of color, you also have to worry about losing your reproductive rights. Just as late as 2014 in the state of California, it was unearthed that there were black women and Hispanic women being coerced into forced sterilizations, and it was all done legally. And then just as late as 2017, you had not a judge, but judges, Ken, who were handing out sentences to black men, literally saying, "We will reduce your sentence by 10 years on a 12-year sentence if you would agree to be sterilized." I mean, this is genocide, literally and figuratively, that we're talking. And so it's those things when you see the law itself that is supposed to protect us being the very instrument that they are using to kill us. The second thing that really inspired me to write this book, and there were many of them, but these are the three that stand out. In the aftermath of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, when the young people, Jenna, refused to remain silent, they refused to let them sweep his death under the rug, because many people in that Canfield community saw with their own eyes that he put his hands up. And the police still shot him anyway. And these young people were having the daily protests. And I remember specifically the National Guard being out there and this young brother who had no fear. They had their assault rifles pointed at him center mass. And he walked straight up to them, almost with his nose touching the tip of the assault rifle. And he told them, "Go ahead and kill me now while all these cameras are watching. You all are going to kill us anyway. It's important to let the world see how you're killing us. So kill me now with the cameras." And that was riveting to me. It stayed in my mind so much. I went to bed thinking about what that young brother was saying. And it was true. It is important that the world sees how they're killing us, and not just how they're killing us in these high-profile police shooting cases, but more poignantly, how they are killing us in courtrooms all over America every day. And you don't have to take Ben Crump's word for it. Just go sit in the back of a courtroom and watch how they're administering justice. You see little white kids come in and they have very similar fact patterns to little black and brown kids. But yet you see the white kids get a slap on the wrist and they're escorted out the courtroom and allowed to live out the rest of their lives and to fulfill the destinies that God have for them and achieve the American dream. But yet these little black and brown children oftentimes are taken to the corner of the courtroom, they're fingerprinted and they're handcuffed and they're convicted of a trumped up felony conviction. And once you have that felony conviction, it is life-changing, especially if you are a poor person of color in America, you know, and you have to wear that felony conviction like a cross on your back for the rest of your entire life. And everybody knows about where you can't vote, you can't serve on a jury, you can't serve in the military, but those are just the tip of the iceberg when you have a felony conviction. I mean, everything that you could try to do to make a legitimate living, now that you have that convicted felon, it's taken away from you. If you're trying to go to college, they won't let you get the Pell Grant or federal loans with this convicted felony conviction. If you're trying to get a legitimate job, if you got a felony conviction, you can't get a certification. You can't get a certification to be a teacher. You can't get a certification to be a nurse. You can't get a certification to be a brick mason. In many states, sisters who want to be beauticians, if they have that felony conviction, they can't get a certification to do that. You know, if you're a real estate agent, you can't get certification. And it goes on and on. In fact, I found out in the city of Atlanta, and you, God forbid anybody would feel like they have to do this, but even women who are performing strip clubs, if you're a convicted felon, you can't get a certification to do that. And it's almost as if they're pushing you back into a life of crime because every month you have to pay these probation fines, you have to pay these mandatory drug testing fees, and it's like it's just a vicious cycle once you're in that system. And most young people who take that felony conviction, these young people of color, they're saying, well, if I go to court, I'm looking at this jury of anything but my peers, and they're telling me that I can get 5 to 15 years. So they say, well, you take this felony conviction and you'll just get 2 years of probation. And you say, shh, I dodged the bullet. But they have no idea what they have just done when they have pled to that felony conviction. And in fact, in many states, I have learned, Ken, that if you are a convicted felon and you spend any time in prison, you can't even get life insurance. It's like you're the walking dead. They just haven't given you the death certificate yet. And so what we try to do is rail against this racist, discriminatory criminal justice system and say that even though they're trying to define you as having no redeemable qualities to society, we still believe in you. We still think that you are the best that we can offer for our community. We still know God has a plan for your life. Because understand, in states like Florida and Tennessee, 1 out of every 5 black men are a convicted felon. And these statistics are very similar in many of the states across the country. And the experts suggest if this trend continues in the next 25 years, it'll be 1 out of every 3 black men in America who are convicted felons. The last thing I will say is this, because I know we have a lot of questions to get to, is open season to legalize genocide of colored people in many ways is an extension of what the great Paul Robeson did in 1951, and at the time he was the most famous African-American in the world, along with W.B. Du Bois, and who was the first African-American to graduate from Harvard with a PhD and one of the founders of the NAACP, and other black leaders. They went to the United Nations Convention in Paris, France, And this is in the aftermath of World War II, when all the war-torn countries are filing petitions of the atrocities and the abuse that they're suffering under the genocide convention and definition, where these black leaders charge genocide against the government for the killing of Negro people in America. And they base this on the daily killings, lynchings, and raping of black people in the 1940s. And they had case after case. And they said, we're using your definition, United Nations, that act or acts with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a group based on national, ethnic, racial, or religious identity. That is what they're doing to us in America. And then they, in conclusion, said the United States government is either complicit with or responsible for creating a genocidal situation to Negro people. And so when you think about the fact that black men only make up at most 7% of the population in America, but yet we make up almost 50% of the population represented on death row, it is creating a genocidal situation. When you think about in nursery school, in kindergarten, you see that black children are being suspended and expelled almost 7-1 than white children. And I scratch my head to this day, why? What could a child do to be expelled from kindergarten? But it is so ironic that those percentages of what they do to the nursery school and kindergarten are very consistent with the statistics of the incarceration of black and brown people in the penal system in America. So we hope to hold a mirror to America's face with this book and say, America, we can do better. America, we have to follow the lessons of Martin Luther King, who said it is it's hypocritical for you to be the moral standard bearer in the world and see injustice and evil and look the other way. Being neutral in the face of injustice in and of itself is injustice. And I conclude by just offering the point that the hypocrisy is everywhere. When you think about the number of black and brown people languishing in prisons for selling marijuana, you know, I just finished the Botham Jaw case, the criminal phase of it, where Amber Geiger, the white policewoman, was convicted of killing this unarmed black man in his own apartment, eating ice cream on his couch. And she only got 10 years in prison. And I think about all those people who didn't kill anybody, who was just selling weed, trying to make money so they could pay their bills. And now that the United States government has, in many instances, legalized marijuana, they are now selling weed, making money to pay their bills. But when we did that, we're in prison. So in this book, we make the case that America, you are not allowed to make profit off of selling marijuana until you let all the black and brown people and other people sitting in prison for selling marijuana out of prison. Because that is what we mean when we talk about equal justice under the law, because we all are American citizens and we all are entitled to expect America to not just recite the preamble to the Declaration of the Independence, but to act like they believe it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for a presentation. It very much summarizes a lot of the things that are said in the book. And what I'd like to do, and maybe take a little bit of time, is just ask you a few questions about the book, have the audience get a little bit of better knowledge of what's in this useful book.
Yes, sir.
So I'd like to start with the title of your book, provocative title, Open Season, The Legalized Genocide of Colored People. And as you say in your opening, you invoke the 1959 UN Convention Against Genocide. There's an intentional genocide against certain people, African Americans in this country, is what the book says. As a matter of fact, in the book you say that there's a conspiracy. That lots of people, U.S. presidents, the Supreme Court, they all have furthered the genocide of black people.
Yes.
But at the end of the book, you talk about your faith in the United States Constitution. You say, I'm steadfast in my belief that the solution to overcoming legalized discrimination and ultimately genocide resides within the Constitution. I'm wondering, do you see a tension between that kind of really gripping and actually depressing diagnosis of the problem and your faith in law as a way to remedy it?
Yeah, I do see a tension, Ken. Even at the founding of our nation, there was tension because the original sin was slavery, and we never have addressed it fully. Even when you think about the Civil War and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, the so-called Civil Rights Amendments, within 15 years after those amendments had been passed, the United States Supreme Court had pretty much neutralized all of them, and we give vivid examples in there, like, for instance, with the 13th Amendment that freed the slaves, except if they are convicted of a crime and you can use it as punishment. Well, very often what we saw happen, and I think it's still happening today, slavery by any other name, is you have black people newly freed from the plantations, and then they would go out and they'll be walking the street and the local law enforcement, sheriff, or whomever will approach them and say, where are you going? What are you doing? Do you have a job? And many times if they said they did not, they then would define that as the crime of vagrancy. And so they would then take the newly freed slaves and in many instances put them back on the same plantation that they were just freed from. And when that was challenged in the Virginia Supreme Court, they issued a holding that is still has never been overturned, and that said, literally, if you are convicted of a crime, you are a slave of the state. And the United States Supreme Court denies a writ, and it was affirmed, and many other states then said the same thing. So what I submit to you all, what if the Supreme Court, this great institution of justice, would have corrected that at that time and said that, no, we want to see prisons as rehabilitation. We don't want to see prisons as this punishment where we think of incarceration as making somebody a slave. And so in the conclusion, I talk about how we need to reimagine incarceration, because I think the Constitution, even though it's not a perfect document, it provides perfect opportunities for us to be better. I think when we look at the amendments, even if the Supreme Court, who's supposed to be the last safeguard, our courts are supposed to be the last refuge against injustice, and I submit many times they promulgate the injustices with this intellectual justification of discrimination. But they have the power. It's right there in the Constitution. The 14th Amendment, when they talk about the fair administration of justice, due process of the law, making it equal, making it fair, it's all right there for them to do it. Because as you teach your students and we all learn in law school, laws are just dead words on paper. We breathe life into them, and we breathe what kind of life they're going to be.
Thank you. So your book is filled with cases that you've been involved with or other cases that illustrate your larger points. And not only sort of the well-known cases of African Americans being killed by the police, but cases of people being prosecuted criminally for registering African Americans to vote in Florida. You actually cite the story of your cousin who was almost caught up in the criminal justice system, but you know was fortunate enough to have some connections to people who could sort of set him on a straighter path. But other people were not be able to were not so fortunate. I'd like you to just talk about maybe a few of the lesser known cases that are in the book that illustrate your larger point. Like the audience is familiar with Trayvon Martin's cases and Michael Brown's cases, but what don't they know that they should know?
Well, I think for every Trayvon Martin, for every Michael Brown, for every Stephon Clark that becomes top news stories, there are literally 50 or so cases that are just as worse that you never hear about, that nobody knows their names, save their family. And Jenna Sarkeesian and I, who works with me, we know so many of them that I don't want to take too much time. I'll try to give you two or three. And my heart still breaks when I think about these cases. Ernest Hoskins in Lonoke, Arkansas, right outside of Little Rock. This 21-year-old kid who was doing everything right. He had served in the military. He and his young bride, who was still in the military, they were expecting their first child. He was working for a company that did a few modifications to help cars get greater efficiency out of fuel. And so he was at his boss's house, who was a 45-year-old white man or so, and his three coworkers. And his boss was lamenting them about they were not hitting their quotas and so forth. And he was their top performing salesman. And he said, well, if we're doing so bad, why don't you get off the couch and help us? Show us how it's done. And that's pretty much what the narrative came out to be. His boss got up from the table when he got his 44 Magnum Desert Eagle gun, came and pointed it at Ernest's head, pulled the trigger, it didn't go off, and then pulled it again, and boom, it blew his brains all over the table in front of three witnesses, two middle-class white witnesses and a young white woman who it was her first day on the job. And the police were called, Ken, and he said, stand your ground. He did not get arrested. It was not until that young woman talked to my law firm and who told the truth, and until his mother and his young bride and I had a press conference almost 2.5 weeks later after the incident, that he was finally arrested. And the hypocrisy of how the law works is because he had resources, he was allowed, and y'all remember that fact pattern, he was allowed to plead to manslaughter because he said he did not intend to kill Ernest, that the gun went off accidentally. He was trying to decock the gun. And he received an 11-year sentence based on the plea agreement, of which he could, with parole, be out in 5 years. And Ernest's case never got the attention of these other cases, but I submit to you, it was far worse than many of them that have gotten the attention. I think of Isaac Singletary. The first time I heard of Stand Your Ground was not Trayvon Martin's case. It was with Isaac Singletary, an 80-year-old black man who was a veteran, who was came from Jacksonville, Florida. He had moved to New York after he got out of the service. He was a cook. His mother got up in age. He decided to move home and take care of his mother. After his mother passed, he decided to stay home in his property that his family was very proud of. He had a house, and then they had a house next to it. Well, since he had left over the years, the government had built subsidized housing projects across the street, and with that came the urban decay. But everybody knew Pops, as they call Isaac Singletary, did not allow any of that drug dealing or anything on his property. And so you had undercover police officers, a Hispanic officer and a white officer, come and set up, I guess, a sting operation where they were selling drugs, and his birth house was vacant and so forth. So they kind of set up there in that yard. Mr. Singletary on a Sunday afternoon came out in his T-shirt and his shorts. His fried chicken was still on the stove in the aftermath. But he came out with his little 22 pistol telling them, get the hell off my land. I don't allow that, and so forth. And, you know, the police claim they identified themselves. However, my experts told us that no way they would have ever did that, because if they do that, their undercover description is revealed, and you would never do that. For the life of me, can't, I don't understand why they just didn't get off his property, but they claim Mr. Singletary shot at them. Witnesses said he never shot, because one thing we know about the projects, people are always outside watching stuff, and you know, they said, no, the old man didn't shoot. He pointed the gun, but then the police shot him, and he kept telling them, get the H off my property, over and over. All they had to do was get off the property. They shot Mr. Singletary. He fell back, and that's the other thing, the distance. He, even if he pointed the gun at them, he was about 20 to 30 feet away from them, they said. The gun, when they shot him, he fell back on the house, stumbled to his backyard, and then the SWAT team came and went in the backyard and took Pops out. They shot him 6 times, and they claimed he never would drop the gun. But that was the first time, stand your ground, I came to conclude, did not work for black people. Because Isaac Singletary went to his grave thinking those were drug dealers, and all he was trying to do was to defend his property. Can you imagine a white person in the suburbs, the police come and set up crime, invite crime on your property, and they don't give the courtesy of coming to you to notify you? And then you end up dead, and they give you the statutory monetary limit that the state pays for killing you, and they say, but nope, the officers aren't going to jail. And so those are some of the cases people don't know about, but are just as egregious. I mean, Isaac Singletary had done everything, served this country, was a productive citizen, and for that, he got killed simply telling what he thought drug dealers, perceived as drug dealers, to get off his property.
All right, so before we, I ask the next question, I should tell the audience, you all have the opportunity to pose your own questions to Mr. Crump. I think there are going to be people walking up and down the aisles, so you just have the opportunity to write your question down on a card, pass it to the aisles, and in about 15 more minutes, we're going to start posing some of your questions to Mr. Crump. All right. So I'm going to ask the next question.
And I'll try to make the answer shorter.
Yes. Well, there's a lot to say.
Yes, sir.
So I know you, in your book, there's last chapter recommendations sort of, you know, 10 things that we could be doing. But I want to ask you more specifically. Okay, you're in Florida. If you could make 3 legal reforms in Florida that would have some effect on the problems you're talking about, what would be your top 3 things to do?
Deep question. I know number one, right off the bat, because we've been railing against it since the February 26, 2012, when Trayvon Benjamin Martin was walking home minding his own business with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea, talking to his friend on the phone. And the neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman profiled, pursued, and shot him in his heart. And then got to sleep in his bed that night. So the first thing I would certainly do in the state of Florida, since we was the first state to pass the Stand Your Ground law, which I am on record, I think is the most racist Jim Crow law that we have ever seen in America. And it's sad because black people and brown people in America, regrettably and unfortunately, we had gotten used to the police killing us and not being held accountable. But this Stand Your Ground law made it where any Tom, Dick, or Harry could kill us and still not be held accountable. And not just not held accountable, you remember that statistic I talked about with black people on death row? The quickest way to get to death row in America is to be a person of color and kill a white person. But yet when a white person kills a person of color, oftentimes they're not even arrested. All they have to say is stand your ground. And so that would certainly be the first law to get rid of stand your ground, not amend it, get rid of it. There was nothing wrong with self-defense. There was nothing wrong with the castle doctrine. Stand your ground was a solution looking for a problem. And the NRA suggested it and bought the legislature and said, now you have the license to use the instruments that we are selling you, and don't worry about any accountability. Just use them. And that's, I just think that's the wrong message to send young people. We set all our problems with violence and guns versus conflict resolution and diplomacy. It's a terrible message. The second thing I would do is, you know, we now have this amendment to restore the rights of convicted felons in Florida because it was 1.4 million people in Florida that could never vote, because if you're a convicted felon in Florida, you can never vote. So finally it was a referendum put on the ballot, and it passed overwhelmingly, and the powers that be then said, okay, well, I know all you black and brown people, majority, it was a lot of white people too who were convicted felons, but overwhelmingly minorities. They said, you can vote, but first you have to pay all the court costs, whatever prison costs, administrative fees we have for you while you were, was tatted up while you were in prison. And so just imagine, you got these poor people of color who been voting, picketing to get the right to vote, and they win. And then they move the goalposts. They change the rules. They say, well, you just got to pay this $5,000 or $6,000. Many of them, as I told you, are convicted felons. They're struggling to get jobs just to be able to pay the light bill. How many of them going to be able to hand over $5,000 or $6,000 to go vote? But that's the hypocrisy in it all when you talk about everybody in America has democracy. Well, not if we get to define you as a criminal, and we have a chapter in the book called about legislative intent, which suggests very simply, we can predict, in fact, we can tell who the criminals are gonna be. I never forget my professor said when I was in college, he said, I bet you all $500, I can get rid of all the crime in America. And, you know, we was kind of dumbfounded. He said, no, we can get rid of all the crime in America overnight, just like that. And I bet you $500 I can do it. And so we were like, okay, Professor Jones, how would you get rid of all the crime in America? He said, simply change the definition of crime. And it's that simple. We have a case in there where a young man, the saggy pants law, who we know exactly who that's identified for, or the, you know, the selling water law. It's directed at poor people who are just trying to find a way to make ends meet. They're trying to criminalize the culture. That way we get to populate the prison industrial complex and get younger, stronger slaves. That's when you look at, and that's the third thing and final thing I say about Florida. I would get rid of that poll tax was number two, that they're now making those 1.4 million Floridians have to pay. The third thing is in Florida, and Jenna, you know, we direct file more children as adults into the adult prison than any other state in America. And it's so sad when you sit in the courtroom and you see that they are direct filing 14-year-old black and Hispanic boys, but not just the boys, the highest growing percentage of people being in prison in America right now are minority women, black and Hispanic women. So we concentrate on the boys because it's so in your face, but the young ladies aren't safe neither. And then they direct file them oftentimes while they're in prison. They're psychologically scarred forever. They're often raped. They lead to having suicide, they said, almost, I think, 36 more times than the average person in America. And these are kids under the age of 18 who are being put into adult prisons. And so those would be the three things. Mm-hmm. If I could make a more perfect union, mm-hmm. that's what I would do.
Thank you. Okay, so I think we're ready to take questions that were generated by the audience members. We got several. If we get through these, we can ask some more.
Okay.
Okay. First question.
Yes, sir.
What advice do you have for a young black or brown person living in a place like Boston, where racism is not as blatant as in, say, Florida, but still incredibly present? What would you give? How would you advise a person like that?
Well, the advice I would give on, and I get it, this intellectual justification of discrimination, because we see it every day. The courts and the Supreme Court and all the other courts, they always figure out, no matter what the situation is, to make sure that people of color get the most of injustice and the least of justice. But what I think you have to do is what we say in the first thing about the 12 personal steps we can all do. You can use your personal platforms to speak truth to power. This book, I endeavored to have it be opportunity for all races to confront our biases, because we all have them, and we constantly have to think about our implicit biases. And so if you're a young person of color, you try to have the dialogues as much as you can by using your influences or your platforms. I used the example of John Legend, not because he has all this influence, because he chose to use his social media every day for 50 days to only talk about banning the box, where convicted felons had to check a box, and once they checked that box, you knew they were not getting the job. And because he then invited everybody else to join him, you can do that. I think about the Howard University law student who called us up and asked Trayvon's parents for permission to start a change.org petition that became the largest petition in change.org history, that said the killer of Trayvon Benjamin Martin should at least be arrested and brought to court to face the witnesses and evidence against him. No, but he didn't know that, 6 million people were signing his petition, but he said, I want to do something to try to make it better. I'm sure there's things here in Boston community that you can try to address by using your platform. I think about Gideon, and we talk about that in Gideon v. Wainwright. This person who didn't even have a high school diploma wrote his petition to the Supreme Court that said, the Sixth Amendment said I had a right to an attorney, and if I couldn't afford one, then one would be appointed to me. But that didn't happen for me. And he just wrote that petition. You got to try to do something. It's better to strike a match than to curse the darkness. And so with this book and with the cases I take, I follow the example of my hero, Thurgood Marshall, that say, you have to do something. They told Thurgood Marshall, he would never go to the best schools. because it was just the reality of life, and that it was a conclusion in law that black people and white people would never go to school together. But Justice Marshall every day said he would wake up and he would do something that was within his power to tear down segregation. We all have that capacity within us. As Dr. King said, we all have a role to play. Not everybody's expected to be with me and Black Lives Matter on the front line, but you can do something with this showing up to city council every week with your group, and you say, I want to talk about this young person who was shot in the back by the police. I want to know why we have all these minorities being charged with felonies and they only make up 5% of the population. You know, just those things that you can do that you don't have to ask anybody else for. It's simply you getting on your computer. It's you going down to City Hall. You mentoring somebody, which is the easiest thing to do. No, we can't save them all. And this racist criminal justice system is still going to continue to target our children. And, you know, we can't outrun racism in America. It doesn't matter how fluent we are. It just doesn't matter. Our children right now, unless we can decentivize the profitability of prisons in America, they're going to continue to target us. But we can try to save one by mentoring. It's like the starfish on the beach. You can't save them all. Well, I saved that one.
Okay. All right, so we've got another one that's sort of about the trajectory that we're on. This person asks, why do things seem to be getting worse and worse and worse? Are they really getting worse and worse? Or is the abuse that has always happened finally being brought to light? You know, what's our trajectory?
Yeah, you know, Ken, I thank God for the advent of technology, that things are becoming more transparent. I think the injustices were always there, but because the internet, because body cameras, you know, when you think of Trayvon Martin, in many instances, it became the number one news story in the world in 2012, not because mainstream media, but because of social media. Mm-hmm. And the young people, I think about Michael Brown and Ferguson, you know, President Obama signed the bill that provided $50 million for all police officers around the country to get body camera video. And so many of them got the grants and got the body camera video so it's transparent. So I think that it's half full or half empty, your perspective. Certainly, I think who we have in the White House is trying to get rid of a lot of the momentum towards equal justice under the law. But I also think when you think about the conviction of Amber Geiger, just a few weeks ago, it was the first time a white policewoman had ever been convicted of murder, of killing a black man in America. So that's some progress. I think about Marquise McLaughlin, who was killed, the parking lot vigilante down in Clearwater, Florida, killed in front of his children. Tragically, he said, stand your ground, because they had the surveillance video. An all-white jury convicted him, and he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Very similar, Corey Jones down in West Palm Beach, Florida, killed Corey. Thank God the tow truck recorder was on. He was an undercover police officer who lied and said he identified himself. Corey went to his grave at 3 o'clock at night on the side of that road. And Corey, I mean, you have so many good kids. And not that you have to be a near-perfect person of color to get equal justice, but it seems like that's the standard they're now holding minorities to, because if they can assassinate your character after they assassinate your person, then they say you're not worthy of consideration. You're not worthy of their giving you equal justice. And the enemies of equality continue to try to use the law to be able to disenfranchise people, to marginalize people, to dehumanize people. people, especially people of color, but we have it within our capacity, I believe, to be able to use the law as an instrument of good. And we have examples throughout our history as a country. So when you ask me about the Constitution and why I still believe America is the greatest country in the world to give the person who is disenfranchised, who is poor, who is marginalized, an opportunity to increase their lot in life. We are by far still that great beacon of hope and justice for all of the world to marvel. We just cannot let the enemies of equality be able to win. That simple. We have to make sure our children are more intelligent than those who would seek to oppress them. We will never, ever win this battle with violence and guns and so forth. The only way we will win this war is with intellect and courage and diplomacy. I digress to say this because Dr. King said that the coward asked the question, is it safe? He said that expediency asked the question, is it politically correct? But he said vanity asked the question, is it popular? But then he said conscience asked the question, is it right? And he said there comes a time when we must all take a position that's neither popular nor politically correct or not even safe. But we must take a position because our conscience tells us it's the right thing to do. I submit to my fellow Americans, it is the right thing to do to not be neutral when you see an injustice, to do something about it, because our country is great because of the individuals who decide to have the courage every day to make it great.
Okay, so we've got time for one last question. I want to just ask, actually, I want to ask a question about media, because you have been someone who's been in the media. You've been controversial for being in the media, for using videos to make cases well known when you take them. For hosting a reality TV show, for doing
Tupac.
Yes, and you have your own production company that's producing producing things for Netflix. Mm-hmm. Now, some people say that that work isn't connected to the work that you've outlined here. So, connect those two people and respond to that criticism.
Absolutely, Malcolm X said one of the most powerful drugs ever created in the world was TV. Because TV, literally, with those images and so forth, put things in your subconscious mind. Have you thinking things you don't even know you're thinking? And so when you see everyday law and order where the police and the prosecutors are always right and honorable and the little minority people are always wrong and criminal and mischievous, it sets in your mind. When you look at forensic files, when you look at all these cable news stations, your newspaper, and they always have these images about black people and Hispanic people being irresponsible or violent and everything, it sets in your mind. And so when you come into courtrooms, you can almost predict what these jurors are thinking before anybody even opens their mouth. And so with what I try to do on television, I think about what Thurgood Marshall would be doing now, because he would always not just take a case that would impact the individual or their family, but he looked for the cases that will have the greatest impact on society as a whole. Because I believe what Justice Marshall was trying to do was trying to impact the hearts and minds of future jurors. jurors who were going to sit in judgment of our children, and we're going to decide whether they became part of the school-to-prison pipeline or whether they got a chance to achieve the American dream. And so with Evidence of Innocence, a show I did with TV One and majority black audiences, when we try now to get it on Netflix, is we have these wrongfully incarcerated individuals, mostly black and Hispanic people, because the Innocence Project has documented that as many as 100,000 people are sitting in American prisons who are completely innocent. And they think that's on the low side, but completely innocent. They commit any crime at all, and most of them are black and brown people. And the reason we think black and brown people are convicted of crimes when they have no evidence whatsoever is because the jury pool has been tainted from the media. They've been tainted from TV. So with these shows, we're talking about how the system got it wrong over and over and over and over again. Therefore, when they come in the courtroom, maybe they won't be so quick to believe the police or believe the prosecutor. And we illustrate in the book over and over again how this prosecutorial immunity is the biggest hypocrisy ever, because they can just convict poor black and brown people, and then when they're shown to not just be a mistaken but willful in putting these people in prison, taking their liberty away sometimes for 10, 20, 30 years. My bad. They only apologize, and nothing happens to them. Mm-hmm. And you see it over and over again. I want to try with these TV shows, hopefully affect these next police officers who have interactions with black or brown people, so they won't be so quick to shoot first and ask questions later. You know, you think about all these cases were unnecessary and unjustifiable. I think about Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I think about Tamir Rice, 12 years old, in Cleveland. I think about Jonathan Crawford in Walmart in Beaver Creek, Ohio. I think about Stephon Clark in his grandmother's backyard with his cell phone. I think about, you know, Botham Jones on his couch with Amber Geiger. I think about Atiana Jefferson in her own apartment minding her business. You think about Philando Castile with his daughter in the back seat. I mean, you think about all these cases, Walter Scott running away, Corey Jones, who just was a black man who happened to have car trouble, and he had to die for that. There, all these cases over and over again, and you just oppose that with confirmed white mass murderers, whether it be the killer in Parkland, Florida, whether it be the Waffle House killer in Tennessee who ran into the woods. The police chased him into the woods. He had confirmed killed 4 people and shot 4 others. He went into the woods, and him and the police all walked out alive. And you say, if that was a black person, ain't no way he would have walked out that woods alive. You think about Dylan Roof, which is, in my mind, the worst one ever, because he killed 9 of the most innocent people you could ever find. And you all remember the interview. He said he felt bad about killing them because they were so kind to him. But yet the police follow him across state lines. And when they interact with this confirmed mass murderer, what do? Do they shoot him and ask questions later? No. They arrest and protect him, because white men get arrested and protected and black men get shot on assumption. And they took Dylan Roof to Burger King on the way on going to jail after he killed 9 black people. And so what I try to do with these TV shows are try to point out to the hearts and minds of America that we can do better. I believe that with everything in my heart, y'all.
Thank you. So I should say something about book signing. Are we going to have book signing here? Out there. Okay. So first, the book is called Open Season, The Legalized Genocide of Colored People by Attorney Benjamin Crump. We will have a book signing out there afterwards. Please stay for that. Thank Mr. Crump for coming here and for sharing his wonderful
book. Thank you,
book
Professor
with us.
Matt. It's a real honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.